Hello, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is March the 22nd, 2022. And this is part two of my discussion with Stefan Tajik, who is an immigration citizenship by investment consultant researcher based in Montreal. Our first podcast discussed the state of the citizenship by investment industry in general, which was hugely interesting. And now, for those who are interested in the U.S. situation, which is almost a separate topic and therefore a separate podcast, which we're now going to start, Stefan wrote a very interesting article in the IMI Daily talking about and describing his perceptions of the U.S. market, which included, I think, an increasing consciousness, at least on the part of Americans, that there is a world out there that they may want to explore a little bit. So welcome back, Stefan. How are you?
Good. My pleasure, John.
All right. Well, we're really looking forward to this one. So I think you and I both agree that all these years with citizenship by investment, you know, really starting in Canada, I guess the late 80s, whatever. But as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, I didn't perceive much discussion about there being a huge market in the United States for citizenship by investment and that sort of thing. Do you agree with that?
I agree totally with that.
So what happened? I mean, like, how come Americans are now interested in citizenship by investment in that?
Well, I think when it comes to, for example, citizenship by ancestry, that always existed to a certain extent in the US. But the attraction to second residency and citizenship, or basically the idea of not only the retirees moving abroad in Mexico, in Panama, et cetera, but other people as well, really start coming in during the 2016 election. And basically the two parties becoming, you say that, more and more distant from one another. So the political climate in the US has basically given a lot of people, lack of peace of mind, if I can say it that way.
You mean they're thinking, I want out of here?
Yes. So we were seeing for a certain amount of time, perhaps, that both parties were going more and more toward their extreme side. And there was a lack of a middle. So basically, for a Democrat, if a Republican like Trump was elected, a lot of them were, you know, a higher amount of them would be, well, I don't feel this is my country anymore. And when Democratic Party won again, certain Republican were thinking, this is not my country. I don't feel this is my country anymore. And I don't feel comfortable living here. A lot of them were interested in moving out of the U.S., you know, especially right after the election, just before the election, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of them were looking for plan B in case I don't feel at home in my country anymore, if I feel I'll be treated better somewhere else, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think probably the politics did have something to do with it. For years, I had a website basically talking about how people could get a license to practice law in Canada, foreign trained lawyers. And I swear to God, the day after the election in 2016, you know, this is just something I just have never taken down. It's been up for years. You know, it gets maybe 50 to 100 hits a day. It had over 1,000 hits within, so in other words, these were licensed lawyers who were looking to, you know, go to Canada or something after that. So, you know, that's interesting. I think that's a factor. Other factors?
Well, there's factors that existed for a long time, which is the tax aspect.
And sorry?
The tax aspect.
Well, that's what makes it difficult for them to believe. But I mean, do you perceive that Americans think they're overtaxed?
Americans are, when you go to the high net worth individual, are some of the most taxed in the world.
Some of the highest taxed.
Yes, some of the highest taxed in the world. The corporate tax used to be the highest in the world by far. Not sure it's the case anymore, but it's still pretty much on the top. tax rates in New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles can, you know, reach to the 50%. Capital gain tax, you know, there's the expectation of hikes, et cetera, et cetera. So you have the estate tax as well that, you know, a lot of countries do not have. So overall, the tax burden for the very rich is very high in the U.S. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Was it 2018 when the Toronto Raptors won the NBA championship? There was all this discussion about whether Kawhi Leonard was going to stay in Toronto or, you know, go wherever. And I remember reading, of course, high-end accounting firms got into the discussion, right? And you can guess what they were talking about was, well, you know, will his tax burden be higher in Ontario or California? And it was quite interesting. I don't remember the exact numbers, but what I do remember is it wasn't much different. And, you know, I mean, surely you would not make the claim that Canada is a low tax country, would you?
No. Not it's not a low tax country. But the difference is, as a Canadian, tomorrow I can leave Canada, break my tax residency, go living a Turk and Caicos and never pay tax again.
Yeah, and of course, for the U, and you can keep your Canadian citizenship, is your point, right?
You can return anytime to Canada.
The U.S. thing is a really, really bad problem. But, you know, I think it's actually such a bad problem that if people understood the extent of it, it might be a deterrence. I mean, they might be less likely to leave the United States.
Yes, and even for new immigrants coming to the U.S., it will surprise me that so many high net worth individuals choose the EB-5 program.
Oh, I think that's, go ahead, explain it. You'll explain as well as I will. But I'll start it off with, I think any high net worth person who invested in an EB-5 thing is completely out of their mind, It's so crazy. But these immigration consultants don't tell you that. You would agree with this?
Absolutely. So that was the same case for Canada. That was the same case for Canada. Nobody told them that when you come here, if you spend over 6 months a year, you're going to have to be a tax resident and pay, you know, twice on your what you're paying in China. You got to pay twice more in Canada on that income that you're making in China. So in the U.S., it's probably going to be even worse.
Well, you know, it's fascinating to me because I sort of operate at the intersection of these two things, right? The moving around and the tax. What's fascinating to me is that, you know, these immigration consultants never lay out, maybe they don't know, but they never lay out the problem. And this is not just going to Canada or the U.S., but I think it's a general problem of people. They don't have to be high net worth. They just have to have assets, you know, like pensions and things like that, of how those existing things they own are going to be taxed if they move to another country, right?
Correct.
And I had an email from somebody out of the blue a week or two ago that comes to mind where, you know, this guy had brought his family from, I won't mention the country, but he owned real estate in this country. And apparently the income from the real estate was not taxed in that country, right? So, you know, what he does is he moves to Canada. And, you and I both know, okay, that the rents are fully taxable, et cetera. And what he said to me in the email, he said, I'm not going to be able to afford to live. You know, if I have to, I mean, it was a complete shock to him, right? So, you know, I wonder, I mean, did you not ask anybody about this, you know, before moving to Canada, right?
I think in a lot of these cases, they don't bother too much, especially, you know, for example, will the Canadian tax agency communicate with the Iranian tax agency and figure out how much assets or income you declare, things like that? It's not going to happen, right? But for Americans, it's completely different. Anywhere they want to relocate, they need the tax experts side by side with the immigration expert.
Absolutely, they do. It's funny, though. I don't think they fully appreciate this at all. You know, a lot of them get themselves into trouble. But all right, so this is interesting. So you and your company, right, have So you set up this company in, what, 2019 or something?
Yeah, we set up, Rogelio founded the company in 2019, probably.
Okay. And, you know, I was aware of it at the time, you know, sort of peripherally. And what I remember was that the idea was to essentially be there for the developing U.S. market, right, for investment migration. And, you know, along with that, I found your recent article in the IMI Daily of great interest, where you talk about, you know, the difficulty of that market and the, you know, what the people are like in that. And, you know, I wonder if you'd share some of those thoughts.
Yeah, of course. First, it's, you know, the traditional investment migration market are China, the Middle East, India, Russia, emerging markets. And we realized it was very different from the US market. So you don't necessarily sell the same products in that same market. The most, you know, obvious thing, it was, you know, a lot of Americans don't need to pay or buy or invest for a second citizenship in the Caribbean, in Europe, et cetera, when they can get it from Ancestry.
So why would they do that?
Well, it gives them, you know, a better passport in pretty much all cases, because, you know, let's say you have Spanish ancestry or you have Irish ancestry. Irish passport is probably the strongest in the world in terms of mobility, right? Better than Malta. But for Malta, you have to pay $1 million. For the Irish citizenship, well, you have to wait at least 2 years right now, unfortunately, to get your passport when you qualify for Irish citizenship by Ancestry. But, you know, it doesn't cost that much, right?
Well, it's a far cry from $1 million anyway. So, I mean, you know, Irish citizenship, Italian, I mean, I think I'm right that French citizenship is a possibility for certain people, you know, Spanish, et cetera. What though, you know, so my perception of the United States is that it's mostly an insular, inward-looking country, right? I mean, you don't have lots of people thinking, well, wouldn't it be cool or wouldn't it be valuable to me to, you know, have a second passport? In fact, apparently, a shockingly high percentage of Americans don't even have an American passport. So, man, what is the value they see in it, right? So, you know, an American, say, reaching, I don't know, middle age or whatever, you know, what is it they're trying to achieve that's different from, you know, somebody coming from, oh, I don't know, say China or Russia for that matter?
So, yeah, that's where one of the, you know, as you pointed out, somebody from China have very clear, precise motivation that are well known to everyone. One is to get a better travel passport. Two is perhaps to send the children to study abroad in top universities, which is, you know, not often the case in China where they can, because it's very competitive. Perhaps retire abroad, you know. In the case of Americans, there's so many motivations. A lot, you know, people just love to retire to Europe. Americans, wealthy Americans, you know, the US is the best place to make a fortune, but Europe is the best place to spend it. You have crypto people that want a second citizenship so they can access exchanges abroad, you know.
And that would mean they're getting rid of their U.S. citizenship.
Exactly. Some of them are simply, you know, to travel on and down the passport for safety reason, let's say, to open bank account, because, you know, Americans, anywhere they go around the world and they want to open a bank account, it's not always, there's no red carpet for them, right? So there's multiple reasons. You know, I had people that would tell me, well, I want to go and invest in countries around the world that I think has the highest return for me. And by doing so, I want to make sure I have a very stable status in that country. You know, I would prefer to have citizenship.
Right.
So I don't care if I have one citizenship or I have 10 citizenship. At the end, you know, this is the way he saw it. And I thought it was very interesting. And a lot of them, you know, it's the plan B that we mentioned, you know, the January 6th event, the last few years events of the political climate, which a lot of people say, you know, it's better to have and not to have. And if they can afford it, spend a bit of time, money for it, you know, why not?
So you're making it sound like, from the point of view of an American, a second citizenship or residency is more of like an accessory. And from the point of view of somebody from other parts of the world, it may be more a clear, tangible, you know, upgrading to their life, right?
Exactly. Practically a necessity. Where in the US, it's something that you have. It's like, you know, have a second house, have a second car or luxury car, and I get a second passport.
Well, I would think that then, you know, I'm trying to tap the American market. I mean, I would think that, it'd be a lot harder to market the product. I don't know. Is that true?
The only I find it difficulty is probably because there are so many different profiles of American consumers for this type of product. So there's different motivation, there's different need for it. But otherwise, you know, there's a big demand for it still.
Well, it seems to me there's a lot of interest. Your article suggests, though, that it's hard to leverage that interest into, you know, the kinds of, professional fees and that are common in other countries, right?
Yes, correct. So obviously, there's a lot of alternatives for Americans that don't exist for Chinese or, Russian, let's say, or somebody else. From an emerging market. We spoke about the citizenship by ancestry, but also for residency, right? You might not need Portuguese golden visa when you can get, you know, a D7 visa, a retirement visa. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're not the same thing. You get a lot more flexibility through the golden visa, but overall, there's so many options.
Yeah, do you have a sense that it's easier for American citizens to, have access to these types of things, you know, get through the whole due diligence thing and, you know, all that kind of good stuff? I mean, do you see it as more administrative than it might be for, you know, citizens of other countries?
As well, the paperwork is probably a lot easier to process for an American than for somebody from an emerging country, which, you know, 20 years ago, didn't have a very solid administrative, units in the country to produce documents and trace back where that money came from, et cetera, et cetera. Also, Americans would qualify for many more programs, you know.
No, why would that be? They're qualified for many more. Can you help me with that?
That can be to language. That can be to the fact that they can more easily open a business. Sometimes it's just the programs. For example, you look at Netherlands, they have something called the friendly country category for the business freelancer. Mm-hmm. So Americans and Japanese, for example, have a much easier way path to getting a business residency in the Netherlands.
That's interesting. It's
extremely easy practically for them.
Now, is that because of treaties or is that just because of, you know, Netherlands laws that just say, well, you know, these are people we know better or something?
Yeah, it's treaties. It's a particular treaty, but you'll find in many countries, Americans have much more doors open to them than
That's
other
interesting.
Countries.
That's interesting. You know, what you're saying makes sense. I don't think I would have sort of thought that up myself, but I think that what you're saying does make sense. So to what extent, though, I mean, obviously, if they want living abroad to be anything more than a hobby for a few months a year, they pretty much have to renounce their citizenship, right?
You mean if they want to spend just a few months a year outside the country?
Well, they wanted to spend a few months out of the year, then I think they probably keep their citizenship. But for those who are, you know, saying, you know, I really want to live my life, you know, in this other country, do you find that they think in terms of, well, that means I'm going to renounce my U.S. citizenship as well? Or
I think the U.S. citizenship to be renounced has to be either a tax reason, or let's say you want to pick up, you live in Germany for many years and, you know, they're asking you to renounce your German citizenship to become your U.S. citizenship to become a German citizen because Germany doesn't accept.
That is a requirement, as I understand. Can you confirm that?
Yes, it's a requirement.
Right, right. And does that mean they actually have to show a certificate of loss of nationality, or does that just mean they have to mouth the words? Because I know in Japan, I think you just have to sort of mouth the words and, you know, it's not treated.
The case of Germany, and in case of Germany, you would need to show a document showing that you don't have that citizenship anymore.
Whereas, for example, Spain, need a certificate of loss of nationality.
Yeah. Whereas, for example, Spain, you just need to orally renounce your U.S. citizenship, which is not legally binding.
Right. And for listeners, the reason for that is that to renounce U.S. citizenship, it's not just saying you renounce it. There's a specific statute that has to be complied with, which is Section 349A of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which means that a renunciation itself needs to take place in the presence of a U.S. consular officer. All right. Now, why would somebody, what would be the advantages, say, we'll work with your situation in Germany here? Why would somebody become a German citizen? I mean, why not just keep living as a presumably legal resident of Germany?
Well, it's true that if you're an American, there's probably not many benefits. Especially,
right. This is probably what if you're an American?
Not many benefits.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because after 5 years of living in Germany, you can apply for an EU long-term resident card, which mm-hmm. gives you a lot of the benefits. Meaning you can basically live and work anywhere in the EU, in the European economic area, just like another citizen can. Mm-hmm. So the only difference, you're probably not going to be able to vote for the elections that are happening, you know, German elections, EU elections, things like that.
Yeah, I think there may also be treaty benefits or lack thereof, particularly with respect to inheritances. But, you know, that's getting really, really technical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, my message is look at the treaties, not that the treaty says anything particular.
Yeah, in terms of mobility, there's not a lot of difference, but other aspects are definitely, you know, we spoke about the tax reasons, tax aspect, obviously, yeah.
So from a business point of view, I mean, where do you think the, you know, as more, you know, sort of an observer of this market, you know, for a number of years, you know, there's a lot of people who seem to be into this stuff now to varying degrees. I mean, do you think that the U.S. is a growth market for, you know, people who do the kind of work you do?
It's very hard to say. I think a lot of investment migration companies have, you know, started receiving more inquiries, right? But how many of them have turned out from leads to, you know, paying customers? That's a different observation.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably true for anybody, but I think it's particularly true. You know, and your article made some, you know, incredibly obvious but valid points that so much of this information is in English, and, you know, they're all, you know, most of them are native English speakers, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you think that in the long run that this whole taxation issue is likely to encourage more Americans to leave, renounce citizenship? Or do you think it's not really big on the radar yet?
I think
well, this, I mean, crypto, you work with an American client. Do they know this in advance, you know, about the whole tax issues, and they can't, you know, whether they leave or not, you know, they've got the same stuff?
Most of them are not aware how unique the U.S. tax system is. That me as a, you know, that they don't realize how heavily they're taxed, one, and that that tax follows them wherever they go, contrary to anybody else pretty much around the world. I mean, you know yourself, there's a few countries in Europe that have certain, you know, aspects of the tax regime that steps into, you know, citizenship-based taxation, or Eritrea that has, you know, citizenship-based taxation. But even Eritrea has been heavily criticized for it by the United Nations and the European Union, even though their tax is very, very small.
Totally benign. The problem with the U.S. tax system is less the taxes than the infrastructure and the, you know, penalizing of everything that's, you know, sort of foreign to the United States. I mean, it's, you know, it may be workable for people who are, you know, planning to, I think it may be workable for people who leave the United States and don't actually become tax residents anywhere else. But the problem is, if you become a tax resident somewhere else, then you're really up against the wall, you know, with two conflicting tax systems that basically take all the benefits away from either one.
I mean, for our clients, this, you know, a certain situation where it could be financially, you know, positive for you to relocate, you know, because you have the foreign earned income exclusion, you have the housing exclusion, all that. To a certain amount of income could be profitable, but when you go past the, let's say, $1 million, $2 million revenues a year, obviously, you know, you're not in the same situation of a
clearly not. And of course, the form of the income, you know, is a huge determinant in that as well. Yeah, that's interesting.
But I think it's gonna grow the demand for this type of services, for the simple reason is that more and more people don't need to be grounded somewhere. You can be doing business in the US, you can be earning your money from the US out of anywhere in the world. A lot of it is being online, so why would you feel that you need to pay that much tax to the US government when you can be, you know, in Morocco doing it, or you can be in Bali doing it, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, on that point, you know, this comes off your website, which is interesting. I mean, I like the organization, a lot of it, but, you know, you've got a section on these digital nomad visas, and maybe you could comment on some of that, because these are, you know, these are things that are obviously not citizenship or residence by investment, but I mean, I think they're hugely helpful to a certain group of people, right?
Yeah, they've been developed in the last few years by countries knowing how remote work has just exploded, right? And a lot of them offer very good tax incentives, meaning, you know, they don't tax you for the amount of time you're there. Obviously, a lot of these visas are for a year or max, you can renew it for 2 years, but they're not, you know, temporary solution.
Well, you can go from one country to the next, I guess, couldn't you?
Exactly, you can definitely do that.
And, you know, I think under the US tax rules that the income is sourced where it's performed. So, you know, if you're making under the 107,000, then you're not even
exactly. Yeah, you can add all those exclusions, so it's very beneficiary for the, you know, let's say a tech worker that's, you know, earning 100 to 250. It's definitely very attractive. You'll definitely pay less tax than we do in the U.S.
But they have to pay the Social Security tax, but maybe that's a good investment, you know, for them anyway. I don't know.
Usually, they're not even taxing those countries. Those that have a very, depends on the digital nomad visa, right? Mm-hmm. But most of them just don't tax you.
So some do, and some don't, you know, or, well, anyway, so to put it generally, there's a difference between immigration status and tax residency. So, you know, when you look at the digital nomad visa, I guess the starting point is what kind of immigration visa is that? And then the second is, okay, I'm there. What does that mean for, in terms of taxation and tax residency? I suppose that's how you would analyze it, right?
Yes, correct. So some of them put, you know, certain paragraph in their law saying we're not going to take any income tax, but there might be capital gain tax that you have to worry about. So
you have
to look at kind of the fine print. And very importantly, it doesn't necessarily mean that the company you work for will not trigger PE rules, permanent establishment rules, or payroll.
Now that's a very, very interesting issue that few people are aware of. Yeah. You know, what does it mean for the company? Because, oh my God, I mean, that could be an unbelievable nightmare if, you know, it's one of these treaties that said that a country can tax the revenue if there's a permanent establishment. So,
yeah. And that's why HR usually tells those employees, come back home right away. You know?
No, absolutely. It's really, I think, a 21st century thing that taxation has become so prevalent in the world. I once did a presentation. In fact, it was at an IMC conference a few years ago. I think I called it something like, in the 21st century, the most interesting thing about a person is his or her tax residency. You know, the 20th century, people talked about things like where their kids were going to college, whether they had a swimming pool, where they were going for vacation. Now they just talk about their tax residency. This place is taxing me. They want to move from New York. Well, not so fast. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. And I think there's something seriously wrong with a world where tax is so front and center.
Yeah, and we had a lot of crypto people, enthusiasts that, you know, really see it as a problem for them.
It is a problem for them. They're right.
And a lot of them plans, because, you know, if you're a believer and you think, you know, Bitcoin is going to hit $1 million and you're at, what, 50,000 or something, you want to plan for that, right? So a lot of them want to go through the hoop even before they trigger, you know, the 2 million net worth, you know,
Very easy to do that. Yeah, very easy to do that. I mean, that's a problem. And, you know, I've had that conversation with, you know, with a lot of them, usually asking the question, well, you know, what is the 2 million thing? Does it include crypto and, you know, this sort of stuff? And unfortunately, the answer is that it does. Well, this has been a great discussion, and I thank you for it. And perhaps we can do round three when you write some more interesting articles. But in bringing this to a close, I invite you to, you know, give some concluding thoughts that would include your coordinates. Where would people get a hold of you?
Yeah, so globalrcg.com. You can find us there, and you can find basically all the solutions we offer to Americans.
Yeah, which, you know, it's a great website. I looked at it the last few days, but I mean, you know, even if you don't use the services, it's a good educational portal, I would say. So I am speaking here with Stefan Tajik, who is a human mobility citizenship by investment consultant based in Montreal. And I thank you very much for participating in this discussion with me today.
It was a pleasure, John.